Has anyone noticed in all of the excitement over our upcoming presidential elections that Canada is holding its big elections on October 14th? That's next week. On today's Underreported, we will look into what's at stake for our neighbors to the north and whether the governing Conservative Party is in danger of being unseated by the Liberal opposition. Adam Radwanski is a member of the Globe and Mail's editorial board, and he writes a political blog for that paper, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's start with the basics, because although every Canadian knows a lot about politics in this country, most Americans know next to nothing about Canadian politics.
So if it's any consolation, not that many Canadians paid attention to this election either until about a week ago. It's gotten kind of short shrift here, and there was some clash last week as to whether we were even going to watch our own debates or whether we'd be watching the vice presidential debate in the U.S. So you're not alone necessarily in not knowing that much about this election.
Now, why is that? Is it because the Canadians just consider this thing a foregone conclusion, and or is it because the U.S. elections are so important ultimately to the way Canadians are going to be in the future?
Well, important and colorful. I think that's the difference, is that in the U.S. you've got a very interesting clash of personalities. I don't need to tell you about that, but both the presidential and the vice presidential candidates have created a really interesting narrative there. We don't really have the same narrative going on here. The foregone conclusion, as you said at the start of the election, was that the Conservatives would be reelected. The question of whether it be a minority government, which is what they had to date in the parliamentary system here, or whether it be a majority government. There's not a lot of excitement around the current Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. There's also even less excitement around the leader of the official opposition here, which is Stéphane Dion, who's a Liberal.
Is he related to Céline Dion?
Because there's no relation. Same
just the same name.
No relation. Just the same name. And he's considerably less colorful than she is as well. Mr. Dion's been the leader of the Liberals for a couple of years. They had, of course, governed here for a long time previously, and has never really gotten a lot of traction with voters, and there was a sense that he simply didn't have a chance of beating the Conservatives. And as I said, there's really been no excitement around the two leaders, and frankly, there was no pressing issue coming into this election. It was called by the Conservatives because they hoped to strengthen their support and maybe get a stronger hold on power.
Otherwise, it would have been held normally next year.
Well, they introduced fixed-term governments, which wasn't the case here before. Our elections tend to be within 5 years of the previous one, but in the parliamentary system, it's traditionally been more or less the discretion of the government when to call it. They introduced fixed terms every 4 years, but because it's a minority government, it's been a very fluid system. And they actually broke their own, the Conservatives broke their own legislation more or less to go to the Governor General here and ask for an election earlier.
How close is the Canadian system to the British parliamentary system? You have a House of Commons, but you don't have a House of Lords.
Well, we do have a Senate, and this is a subject of some debate here as well. The Senate is an appointed Senate. It's meant to ensure regional representation that's not provided by our House of Commons, where the elected MPs sit. But there's been a great deal of debate here about whether we should reform the Senate, whether we should abolish the Senate. The Conservatives are a party that wants to either reform or abolish it. The Senate is – that's partly because the Senate is dominated by Liberals, because it's an appointed system and the Liberals were in power for so long. The Senate is mostly controlled by the Liberals. It basically is supposed – it's supposed to be the sober second thought, where our legislation goes after it's passed by the House of Commons. In a lot of cases, it's a bit of a rubber stamp. It will occasionally get in the way of what the government wants to do. But there's a perception in much of the country, particularly in Western Canada, that it's basically a waste of time and money in a place where patronage appointments are made.
But it sounds very much like what goes on in Britain, and even the Prime Minister is formally appointed by the Governor General on behalf of the Queen.
That's right. It's much the same. It's much the same system here. The big difference, traditionally here, I think, has been that there's much more party discipline here than there is in Britain. Whereas you'll see members of Parliament in England, even in the House of Commons, questioning their own government here, the disciplines are much more rigid, which has meant that traditionally majority governments here have had a great deal of power, and the Prime Minister has had a great deal of power, with very little opposition from within his own party, and very little ability on the part of the opposition to stop him from doing whatever he wants. The difference in the last couple of years, 2.5 years, or actually the last four, because the Liberals had a minority before, is that we've been grappling with how minority governments work. And it becomes a real brokerage politics system where the governing party has to constantly be making deals with the opposition parties to get anything done. So we've seen a lot more compromise introduced into Canadian politics than there was previously. For instance, on our future in Afghanistan, the Conservatives who were in power have been relatively hawkish. The Liberals had actually put us in Afghanistan, but are a little more dovish, and then the other parties further to the left of them are want us out of there right away. And we wound up with a compromise negotiated where Canada is to exit combat operations there in 2011. So that kind of compromise is something that the parties are just learning how to deal with. And what further complicates that is that the current Prime Minister, Mr. Harper, who's probably still the likeliest to be reelected, has a very well-earned reputation as a control freak. He's within his own party and more broadly, and is not compromise does not come naturally to him, nor necessarily does it come naturally to the leader of the opposition. So it's been a very, very contentious couple of years here. There's been a lot of conflict in the parties, a lot of acrimony. It's become in some ways more viciously partisan despite the need to compromise. And this election has really reflected that and has, in fact, been a very, by Canadian standards, maybe even by American standards, though they tend to be a little more civil here, but this has been a very, very vicious campaign. It's been dominated for most of it by, the parties' war rooms attacking each other, by online attacks. It's just been a very vicious campaign, and I think it's actually turned a lot of people off until the last week or so.
Well, I understand that a Canadian debate was held on the same night as the U.S. vice presidential debate. And the ratings were better for Sarah Palin and because she's, do some people see her as a Canadian?
I think it's more because people just see her as an interesting figure. I mean, there's an element of celebrity that comes into American politics. The other thing that you have to bear in mind if you're watching the contrast between the two, and I mostly watch the Canadian one at the time because that's my job. People I spoke to socially who I'd asked what they thought of the Canadian debate all told me they'd watch the American one. There's a real just difference in what's more appealing to watch, frankly. The American one was a one-on-one conversation, debate, whatever you want to call it. The problem we have here is there are actually five different leaders debating in ours. There's the Conservatives, the Liberals, the New Democrats, which is sort of a moderate socialist party, the Green Party, which speaks for itself, and the Bloc Québécois, which is the nationalist Quebec party. So with all five leaders in that debate, it really does not make for very compelling theater. I mean, you're looking at them talking over each other. There's not much engagement one-on-one. And, there are two people who legitimately have a chance to run the country, Mr. Harper and Mr. Dion, but there wasn't all that much back and forth between the two of them because the others were constantly cutting in. So you watch about 5 minutes of that, and you say, okay, well, enough of this, and you switch over to the one which is actually good theater.
Well, let's talk about those parties for a moment because the names Conservative and Liberal mean something very specific in this country. Should I assume that the Conservative Party in Canada is closer to the Tories in Britain than to the kinds of Conservatives we have in this country?
Well, it's a mix. It's a mix. It used to be a very kind of centrist party. I mean, both of the major parties were quite centrist, and it was the Progressive Conservative Party nationally until the early 1990s.
They were closer to the American Republicans and the Liberals
Democrats? I mean, frankly, they were probably around where the Democrats are ideologically, and the Liberals were to the left of there. They were a more traditional conservative party, meaning, there was more of a social conscience aspect to it. A little more fiscally conservative than the Liberals were, a little less activist, but generally, there's a term red Tory, which applied quite well here, which is, basically a, sort of a centrist, traditionalist. They were more or less supplanted in the 1990s by the Reform Party, which was a much more conservative, much more Republican-style party that came out of Western Canada mostly, which is Alberta in particular is a much more conservative part of Canada.
So you have your red province, blue province thing? This is similar to what we have
read. We do closely. Of course, you don't carry a province in the same way here because it's made up of seats, so it's not quite as consistent. But Ontario, the largest province in the country, is traditionally, or at least in recent years, has been more of a red province. It's more of a liberal province. Alberta is almost uniformly conservative. In fact, almost they'll probably win every seat there. And that movement in the early 1990s, the reform movement, had come out of there. There was then this long competition between the reformers, who were the more kind of Republican-style turn the government, you know, smaller government, more socially conservative party. And the Progressive Conservatives, who were the traditional conservative party, who had fewer seats, were still kicking around. The two parties eventually merged earlier this decade and wound up winning power in 2006. So what they've become is sort of a combination of the old, more moderate British Tories and the more ideological, sort of more right-wing Republican Party, and there are some Republican there are some ties, not formal ties, but you will get some people who've, you know, who've worked on Republican campaigns advising our parties, our conservative party here, and they've modeled some of their attacks and some of their techniques after the Republican Party. So they're certainly not as conservative as Republicans. They're not socially conservative particularly anymore. They were, and that's such a non-sailor here that they've dropped it. So, you know, whereas they had staunchly opposed gay marriage here, which is now legal across the country, they staunchly opposed that. They sort of half-heartedly went about opposing it, and when they were in government, have now basically accepted it. They don't go near abortion as an issue because it's such a hot button here, and it's proved a bit of a killer for you know, for conservative parties. So they stay away from the really hot button stuff mostly, with the exception of crime, and tend to be just a little bit more of a smaller government party. More of a tough on crime party, that sort of thing. But they're not quite as staunchly ideological as the Republicans are.
So it sounds to me like the Canadian parties are somewhere between the American parties and the British parties. Is there a Canadian equivalent of the British Labour Party? Is that the new Democratic Party?
Well, that's what the new Democratic Party wants to become. And the leader of that party, Jack Layton, has done a fairly good job of kind of professionalizing that party in a way. It's a party that traditionally has been basically a protest party. It's typically, in the older system, before there were quite as many parties as there are here, when there was the Liberals and the Conservatives, the NDP was the third party. They were sort of they considered themselves to be the conscience of Parliament. They had a bit of a heyday in the 1980s where they won quite a few seats. Really declined in the 90s, and it became a party that was sort of, you know, they you'd see their members turning up at anti-globalization protests and that sort of thing in the 90s. So really, we're kind of flirting a little bit with the margins, or in fact, we're on the margins. Mr. Layton has tried in the last few years to make them more of a mainstream party. For instance, he will swear up and down in this election that if elected, they would not run the deficit under any circumstances. You know, that's the sort of thing that Democrats would not have said in the past. They've run a much slicker campaign than previously. They try to speak about fiscal responsibility more often. So he's trying to bring them more into the center and into sort of where New Labour went in Britain.
Yeah, Tony Blair.
That's to the chagrin of some members of his own party, because that is where, you know, sort of social activists have wound up. But what he sees is an opportunity to supplant the Liberals as the party of the center-left, because they've been quite weak in the last couple of years. There's been a lot of infighting within the Liberals. They've not generally rallied around their leader. And they've been polling at about 25% nationally, which is very low for the Liberals. The NDP has crept up to about 20%. So what they're seeing is an opportunity in the long run to become the real opposition party, or the real opponent to the Conservatives. Now, I think it's a long shot in this election, but that's what they're trying to do, and that means sort of forcing them more into the center, which is something there's a lot of resistance to within the party, but something that Mr. Layton seems quite hell-bent on doing.
My guest is Adam Radwanski, who is a member of the Globe and Mail's editorial board and also writes a political blog for his newspaper, and we're talking about the Canadian elections coming up next week, elections that will decide leadership for as much as 5 years in Canada. By the way, this segment, this underreported segment, was suggested by a listener. We're always appreciative of listeners who make suggestions that we think are actually interesting. A listener has written in and wants to know about the Green Party's role in the election cycle, because Green Party leader Elizabeth May has a fairly high profile. Is this the same Green Party we have in the United States? And this person asks, and does her high profile this time around mean that the Green Party is likely to have some kind of impact on the Canadian political scene in the future?
It's unaffiliated with the American Green Party, and it's traditionally been very marginal here. It's been around for a long time and has not had much impact. This was the first election in which the Green Party leader was brought into the leaders' debates, mostly because her party's been polling at around the 10% mark nationally, which is pretty strong. The problem that Ms. May faces is that her party's unlikely to actually win any seats. The way that it works here, obviously, is you have to have a really effective vote. You have to have votes concentrated in one particular riding to actually win it. We have 308 ridings nationally. It's like a congressional district. The problem that she has is they're polling at a later 10%, but in no riding in the country are they really polling at a level where they're probably going to win, with the possible exception, this is unlikely, but the possible exception of her district in Nova Scotia. So the likelihood of them winning any seats is somewhat marginal, meaning that they're not going to have much role in the next parliament. They do have a strong role in this election because what's happened is that they're sucking votes away from the Liberals and then the Democrats, which are the two parties that that are hoping to unseat conservatives. It's becoming more difficult for them because there is the 8 to 10% range that they're drawing is largely away from those two parties. That vote may go down a little bit on election day, but still it looks as though they're going to draw quite a few votes. And there's a combination there of a couple of things. One is legitimate interest in the environment. Perhaps I should say three things. One is legitimate interest in the environment. The Liberals have run on quite a green platform themselves, but if you're really preoccupied with the issue of global warming and other issues, other eco issues, you're going to look to this party a little bit. That's one. Two is the protest vote aspect. I mean, this has been quite a disheartening election to follow. Certainly, those of us who followed it closely and professionally have found it to be, at some points, difficult to stomach and very vicious. I think some people are just saying, all right, the Green Party sort of a none-of-the-above vote, not dissimilar maybe from what Ralph Nader has achieved in the U.S. In previous elections. The third factor is that Elizabeth May herself is quite a compelling personality. She performed, I think, better than most people would have expected in those debates that I mentioned, never having done one before and having a much less sort of professional organization behind her. You can't totally discount the fact that she's a woman and there are the other parties are all led by men. But for the very, very brief prime ministership of Kim Campbell in 1993, we've not had a lot of successful female politicians on the national stage. So I suspect that that's also drawing a few votes. I know that people, a lot of women were impressed by her performance, particularly in that debate.
Has the financial crisis that's had such an impact on the American political situation and seems to be affecting a lot of the European countries played a part in this election?
Yes, it's played a huge part, actually, and that's.
But you would have assumed it would have hurt. You would have assumed it would have hurt Stephen Harper, wouldn't you?
It has. Yeah, and what's happened is very interesting here in the last week or so. People were really tuned out of this election until a few days ago. The financial crisis has obviously become the dominant issue here, and earlier there were a bunch of other issues in the campaign. This is now it. I mean, this is the big issue. The parties aren't offering anything radically different from one another on this. And traditionally, the Conservatives have actually – or not traditionally, but more recently, the Conservatives have actually been stronger on the economy in terms of their polling numbers. They're perceived as being pretty good fiscal managers, not spending a lot. So you would generally expect this to play to their advantage. What's happened in the last week or so is that Mr. Harper, from a strategic point of view, has quite badly misread the issue. He's basically talked extensively about what a good job his government is doing in sheltering us from economic fallout. What he's not shown, and this has become almost a cliche here and noting it in the last few days, what he's not shown is any degree of empathy whatsoever toward people who are going through this, through the crisis, people who are worried about their homes, worried about their investments, worried about their pensions, and so on.
Hasn't he admitted to be emotionally inexpressive or something along those lines?
Slightly emotionally impaired, yeah. He's not a warm guy, but he had a major speech on Tuesday of this week that he gave in Toronto. It was a major luncheon speech here and probably a pivotal moment in the campaign. And he really failed in that speech to, I think, capture the feeling in the country, which was This is, you know, we're in borderline crisis here. We're going into recession, most likely. People are really worried. And his speech came off as almost glib, and he made the mistake a couple of times that day in subsequent interviews on television of repeating this line that, well, you know, there's obviously concerns, but hey, at least it's a good time to, you can buy low on stocks, which is just a really strange thing for somebody to say in that situation. True, though, maybe from an investment point of view, it's just not the way that you want to convey as a leader. Conversely, the Liberal leader, Mr. Dion, gave a speech yesterday in Toronto, again a pivotal moment in the campaign. This is sort of the media capital of the country. Gave a much different kind of speech, and he's generally not considered a very strong public speaker, and he's not, but delivered a very strong speech, and one where he seemed to have a much better grasp of people's concern of the issues, was a little more emotional about it, a little more. It seemed to resonate a little bit more. And what we've seen in the last week or so is a real move in the polls. The conservatives were polling at about 11, 12, 13, even higher percent above the liberals. And since we're on the verge of majority government, we've now seen that lead shrink to about 5 points in the last few days. And so it's actually become kind of a competitive election because Mr. Harper seems to have misread or just not reacted properly to the real creeping concern about the economy here.
Now, you mentioned that the campaign has been really negative. In fact, one of your colleagues at Globe and Mail, Roy McGregor, has called it the ugly campaign. How is it financed? Is it the same sort of thing as we have in the United States?
No, it's a fairly complicated system. There's been a lot tighter rules brought in the last few years on it, on campaign finance rules. Donations aren't allowed over a certain level. There are some similarities. I mean, you can't donate over $1,000. There's been limits to corporate and union donations. There's a cap on how much you can spend during the campaign period of, I believe, $18 million. The parties are basically on a level playing field during the election itself, and there's a public financing aspect to it. Where the sort of public funds match private donations, and there's a, or more correctly, it's based on a share of the vote. You get a certain amount of money allocated for every vote that you get in the previous election. So partly publicly financed, partly privately financed. The major parties are all able to spend, even requires a bit of borrowing, are able to spend basically at the limit. So during the actual campaign, it's fairly level. Where the conservatives had a big advantage was in the what we call the pre-red period, the period before the election was called, when there's no limit on spending. There's limits on how much you can donate personally, but they've had a much more effective fundraising machine and were able to spend a lot more on attack ads on the Liberals, which helped to set the stage and I think really helped them paint a picture of Mr. Dion, the Liberal leader, before he was able to paint it himself of being, they have a website that's not a leader.ca, which
Adam,
is just attacking him.
We have just a less than a minute left, but I wanted to hit three other topics very quickly.
Well,
NAFTA, immigration, and the separatism, the Quebecois separatist movement. Are they issues in this election?
NAFTA, no. Separatism is a very – I can't give you a short answer to that, but to say that there's a real debate in Quebec about the refusal of the Bloc Québécois, which is a separatist party that has had the most seats in Quebec for years, but seems to have somewhat outlived its usefulness and seemed to be on the decline before it had a resurgence during this election. The third one, immigration. We barely talk about immigration in this country. It's a taboo. The conservatives stay way away from it because although there's a very legitimate debate to be had about immigration policies, every time they go near it, they wind up being attacked for being intolerant. So they just stay away from it, and the Liberals are basically a pro-immigration party.
We have a link to your political blog on our show page at WNYC.org if listeners want to read more about Canadian politics. I didn't get to ask you about your other career as a music critic before you got into politics, but some other time perhaps. And my great thanks to you, Adam Radwanski, who's a member of the Globe and Mail's editorial board and writes a political blog for his newspaper. I'll be following the elections closely.
Thank you.